tasty treat will double your enjoyment of the show.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Tea Time, a series where we discuss topics related to trick takers, shedders, climbers, and other card games. I'm Ryan.
I'm Patrick.
And we are joined by a special guest today. So if Dan, you'd like to introduce yourself now.
Hi, I'm Dan Thoreau.
Wonderful. And some of you might know, that's a beautiful introduction. I love it. Short and sweet. Some of you might also know him as Space Biff.
That's me.
Yeah, writes a lot of articles on, the website is just spacebiff.com or?
Yeah.
Yeah. So for any listeners who might not be familiar with that site, you want to just give us a little bit of a background of what it is you write on there? I'm sure it's board game related, but if you want to just give everybody a little bit of idea what you do.
Sure. So I write about board games. Yeah, that's pretty much it. I've been writing about them for something like 10, 11, 12 years, mostly on Space Biff. I write for a few other sites as well. But that's pretty much it. My goal is to try to do good criticism.
Yeah, no, that's always good.
To put it eloquently, good criticism.
How can you criticize that opener? I think that was great.
It was good. It's very good. So you said you've been doing it for a while. I think when I went to Space Biff's to do a little history checking, the first article you posted was on September 20th, 2011.
Oh, okay.
Just a couple of weeks ago then, Dan.
Do you think you could remember what it was?
Oh, no. About like a video game, Dominions?
Yeah, it was like Rock, Paper, Shotgun, Dominion 3, or I honestly don't remember now. I didn't actually write it down. I was just trying to see if you'd remember.
I was convinced you were going to say Rock, Paper, Scissors then, and that was the first review.
Yeah, but yeah, it was absolutely a video game. It had pictures of video game stuff, and when you click on the link, it brought you to a video game developer.
That makes sense. I love play-by-email games, and actually that's one of the origins of me getting into board games was just playing video games that you can play by email. Dominions is a really good one. Another was Solium Infernum. And a lot of those take cues from modern board game design.
Yeah, it's actually interesting with even the past 5 years or so, so many board games are getting based off of video game IPs and they're trying to replicate a video game in a board game style. So we've certainly gotten there.
Yeah. And it's fascinating the way that those two spheres cross-pollinate, isn't it? Like the new XCOM draws a ton from board games.
Yeah, there's been quite a lot of crossover. I mean, you only have to look at Frost Punk, and we've also had The Witcher. We see a bit of that, and a lot of the Marvel IP, even. Ryan, we know how much you love that. You've talked about it on Tea Time episodes as well.
Oh, cool.
So yeah. Quite a nice crossover.
Lots of Marvel stuff, specifically Marvel Champions is what Patrick is talking about. But so the big reason why we brought Dan on, as you could probably guess, being trick talkers and all about trick-taking games, Dan himself has been getting into the trick-taking Renaissance, as everybody keeps calling it now. I'm sure we'll allow Dan to speak his mind on that and how he started getting into trick-taking games. But the biggest thing that I noticed Dan talking about trick-taking games was the new series or current series you have on your Space Biff website called This Trick-Taking Life. There are currently two articles out right now, correct?
That's correct, yeah.
Yeah, the first one was about the suits, and the second one was about the triumphs or Trump suit in general.
Yeah.
And I don't want to spoil them too much, so please go ahead, take a look at them, give them a read. We'll put the links in the show notes for them. Obviously, amazing articles, just like everything else Dan writes. But yeah, Dan, so if you want to give us a little bit of a background on what got you into the trick-taking renaissance?
That's a great question. A big part of it, I think, is first of all, the Renaissance, right? It didn't happen on its own. I didn't just decide to become involved in trick takers. The weird thing is that I grew up in a household where we weren't allowed to touch or interact with face cards. And that really stunted my appreciation of trick takers. We played plenty of board games, not good ones. They were always the terrible games that, you know, Monopoly, Kid Edition, and the Game of Life. Or eventually I got into some better games and my parents eased up a bit, like Catan. There was a two-player Catan card game that I played with my father quite a bit. But growing up in a Mormon household, face cards were of the devil. And I don't know where that started, that face cards would be like the portal for the devil to come into our universe. But there it is. Although I say that, I don't know, but I do know a little bit that it actually has roots in trick taking. Because women back in the day in Utah would get together and play bridge. And they would have bridge clubs. And within the hierarchy of Mormonism, this was frowned on because women were getting together. And I don't know if you know much about Mormonism, but it tends to be a very patriarchal religion. And so that was frowned on by certain men who didn't like women getting together and gossiping and talking about the men in their lives. And so suddenly, out of nowhere, face cards are of the devil. And this is actually published in a few Mormon books, and it's not an official declaration that the church had, but it kind of trickles out, and suddenly women aren't supposed to get together and play card games. And my mother came from a very borderline fundamentalist family. And so her father had enforced rules like this all the time. And so suddenly here I am and I want to play with cards. And no, that's not something we do. And so eventually I married into a family that played these games all the time. And it was a little bit embarrassing because my wife was so good at them. And, you know, occasionally I would meet with a family or get to know somebody who would want to play a trick-taking game. And first of all, I had to get over my knee-jerk impulse where I was going, oh, is this okay? Are you allowed to touch these face cards? Sort of a goofy, you know, you're raised in one of these religions and sometimes you don't recognize its problems right away. But my wife's family was very much into card games growing up. They played trick takers all the time. And so I was introduced actually to modern board games and to trick takers largely through my wife. Now, I had played, of course, some other games. I had played trick takers incidentally. I had played Catan, you know, speaking of modern board games. But she just was so open with board games and trick takers. And unfortunately, it means I kind of didn't like them at first because I would sit down and play a trick taker and she and her family were all like wizards. Because I don't know if you know this, Ryan and Patrick, but when you first play a trick taker, it just feels like you're all just playing a card and then somebody wins and there doesn't seem to be any strategy. It feels like it's based on the deal and nothing else. And that's how it felt to me as a newcomer, especially walking into a room full of sharks. And I was going, man, these people are all getting good deals all the time. I just have nothing but bad deals. And so my wife introduced me to them and I didn't like them for years. But then this renaissance started happening and I was so enamored with a few of the trick takers that I was playing. And there's no one title that did it. It was just this accumulation of titles that are doing such innovative, exciting things and are so fun to interact with. And I go into this a little bit in the series, is just what is the appeal of trick taking and what is its history and why is that kind of vibrant and exciting? But that's my personal history with trick takers and why I didn't like them very much. And it's been a very gradual but very enjoyable road to travel.
Yeah, it sounds very eventful from the start to where you got now. And I can imagine, like you said, the very start when you first started playing with your wife's family and how you felt like you were getting bad deals. And I'd also imagine like the lingo, trick taking in itself, all of the words trump and must follow, may follow, and sloughing and all those things. If you've never played it before and somebody doesn't potentially teach it to you right away, if everyone around the table knows and they're just starting to play these cards really quickly, it can probably become right. overwhelming even faster, I'd imagine.
That's a great observation that I hadn't really thought of, because the first time I do remember sitting down and people are like, okay, to claim this trick, you do this. But this suit is trump, but it can change. And I'm going like, oh my goodness.
And it's that lingo that it's across 95% of trick taking games. So it's like, oh, you say, oh, trump can change. It's revolving. You do this. Everyone around the table is like, okay, I got it. Let's go. I know what we do. What's the small little twist to it? But then you're just like sitting there going, eyes glazed over. What did they just say?
Yeah. How did you two? I mean, because now you're like the official spokespeople, because you are literally the trick talkers. What was your origin in this?
Patrick, would you like to go first?
I can go first. I can see you're dying to, Ryan, but, you know, I'm sure it'll be worth the wait. In my case, the card game Wizard was my in to trick taking. I think I always liked hearts, and I'd always liked that there are about a million different rule sets, different ways of playing hearts, but there's only so many times you can play hearts until you start looking for things outside the box, so such as Wizard. And from there, Skulking, I kind of progressed into that and realized that there are all these other types of trick taking games out there, because Skulking is a raucous wild time. I don't know if you've ever played that one, Dan, but
yeah
absolutely wild. So that hooked my friends into it, and then it was easy. I fell down the Japanese importing rabbit hole a couple of years ago, met Ryan, and the rest is history. Because if you've got a wallet and you've got access to these websites, then it's a very slippery slope, but it's also a lot of fun. So I think that's how I ended up where I am. And it's so much easier to get some of these games played than when you pull out a big Euro game off the shelf and say, hey, do you want to do three or four of these in one night, or just a few trick takers and have a chat?
Well, that's part of the beauty, isn't it? You learn one and you've learned 1,000 games,
right? The cross lingo, the language between all these trick takers.
Yeah, it's almost a little bit of a blessing and a curse, though, because you end up getting the issue of like, oh, well, I know that this one says must follow. So you skip over the next like 2-3 sentences because your eyes just go, yep, right. I got it. But then you realize that it's a must follow with this exception to it. And you might have missed that exception because you glanced over too quickly. It almost becomes that certain threshold where you become so advanced at knowing trick taking games, you have to be careful that you don't just start giving yourself those expectations and, you know, planning on, oh, I'm going to know how to play this game right away. You got to actually go through all the rules still and make sure you're not missing that twist.
Right.
Right. The worst is when you look in the rule book and it's, if we both play the same number, who wins? Is it the first one down, or is it the one that goes afterwards? And that's always seems to be the snacking point when you realize you've got too many trick taking games, if that's possible.
Yeah, we just played Arum. Okay. Have you heard of that one?
Indeed.
Oh, yes. That is designed by Shirish Bhatt.
Have you played it?
Yes. I have actually had the luxury of being able to play test it early on playingcards.io when it was under its older name.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, so we just got a Pandasaurus. I guess they're publishing it now.
Yep.
And they sent me a copy last week. So we just played it for the first time. And it does something really cool where, so whoever wins the trick, you know, high card, So it's a no follow trick taking game, right?
Yeah.
So you cannot follow. And so we played it for the first time, and so and the goal is to have the high card. But then whoever comes in, is it lowest, gets a gold card. But we had the question come up where everybody played an eight, because it was like we were all daring each other. You know, someone plays an eight, someone else plays an eight, because normally whoever plays last is the one who takes the trick if you're all tied. And so the question came up, so the last player to play that eight won the trick, but that's also the lowest card. So do they also win the gold? And the answer is yes, it turns out.
Mm. Yeah. And it makes for a funny play when you do like that. You said daring each other to do it. And it's one of those where you're just like, oh, play an eight. You won't play an eight. Yeah, sure, I'll play the eight. And then everyone else around the table slowly plays it.
Yeah.
It's one of those where like everybody beforehand could have stopped it. But what if the last person has higher than an eight, then you're still going to be the lowest number. So you're trying for it.
It's that risk-taking element, isn't it? That makes it so addictive.
Yeah, I know. Aurum is a lot of fun. I know it'll be coming full available retail through Pandasaurus in, I think, the end of this month, maybe in July.
Yeah, something like that. It was one of those games. Pandasaurus is one of those publishers who will just send out games to reviewers without telling you about them. So it just showed up. So I actually don't know any details about it.
I did at one point, but I can't remember because it was available for pre-order. But since I am on a current buying freeze, I'm less paying attention to exact dates of things. Yeah. So not sure if you're aware, Dan, Patrick and I both have a challenge for ourselves. Patrick's is that he can't buy more than 12 games in this calendar year. That includes trades and anything else.
It is brutal. Yes.
Including trades.
Yeah.
I must be mad. And to be honest, I may have to tweak some of the rules because we have to go through life setting ourselves up for success. And I feel like I've set myself up here for an epic disaster.
Well, tell them how many games you're already at.
Do you want to have a guess, Dan?
11.
Yeah, I'm at 11. And
beautiful guess. It's perfect. Yeah,
the thing is, the last game I bought was Scapegoat.
Ooh. I love Scapegoat.
So would you say, Dan, that that's worthy of one of 12?
Oh, yeah. I love Scapegoat.
You did a great article on it, actually. I think that's what probably pushed me to the buy button.
Scapegoat. John, everything John Perry does, I think he is brilliant. And he does so many cool things with minimalist design because Scapegoat is not complicated, but there's really no social deduction game like it. It's one of the most paranoid social deduction games out there. So, yeah, that doesn't count toward your 12.
There we go.
You get a freebie.
Dan said it. That's Ryan, a cheat day. So we've had a guest come on and say it. So
perfect. Everyone just heard it now. That one doesn't count, Patrick. So you're at 10 out of 12.
I feel vindicated. Thanks, Dan.
It's perfect.
Anytime. Yeah.
So does that mean almost all John Perry games don't count? Because I feel like Air, Land, and Sea is also a fantastic game.
It is.
Air, Land, and Sea is incredible. So I also give you permission to buy Air, Land, and Sea.
That's on my shelf. I just need to look for Time Barons now by the look of it.
There you go.
Spots is just lovely.
Yes, it is.
That's also a freebie.
There you go. Perfect. So anything John Perry, you're good to go.
Yeah.
Okay, sweet. I'll have to add that clause in a bit later tonight.
Yeah, that's called the John Perry exclusion.
John Perry.
It's in every game collection rules. It's in the bylaws.
There you go. Signed, sealed, delivered, right?
There we go. From Space Biff to Trick Talkers, presented and dated.
So, yeah, just going back to a couple of minutes before with your question there, Dan, on how we got into it as Patrick went over his, feeding off of that, because, of course, I got to get my pitch in here. I'll keep mine shorter, though. Skull King was a big component in my world as far as getting into main modern trick-taking, as most people, also before that, traditional card games being Hearts and Spades, played that a lot. But I also played Cribbage a bunch, which isn't fully a trick-taking game, depending on who you ask and how you know squint and tilt your head. You could see how it could and couldn't be. But I played that a lot with my mom and grandfather growing up, so that had a lot of influence for me just in card or in traditional card game type stuff. But then, as Patrick said, well, how we met each other was actually through the Portland Game Collective Discord server. And how that pretty much started was through Bridge City Poker, designed by Lee Gianu. Okay, yeah. And fantastic game. The one that my wife fell in love with. It's one of the few games that she will ask me to play. And when you know she's asking me to play, then that's like a keeper no matter what. And when Patrick and Johnny, our other third host, who is currently not a part of the show at this time for family reasons, but he sort of reached out to Patrick and I asking if we wanted to start this show. So we didn't know each other at all before the start of this show. And it was just
Yo-Kai Septic, Ryan. I knew you as the Yo-Kai man. The guy who knew all the rules for Yo-Kai Septic and taught everybody Yo-Kai Septic. And that was how I knew Ryan, of this person who existed to teach that game.
It's true. But you didn't really know me, because I'm not the Yo-Kai man. That is a self-appointed name that you gave me. So I just want to point that out, too. But yeah, I mean, so that's kind of our thing as far as, like you said, being the trick talkers and the people in the trick-taking world. I don't know if I would give us that true title yet, only because we just started doing it on our own. But I mean, I'm totally enjoying it. I'm loving doing this. And obviously, we're happy to have you on. And the discussion we're having today is great. And the fact that whether it's the trick-taking renaissance or whatever that led you to this moment to play more trick-taking games is great.
Yeah, I've written lots of reviews of trick-taking games where I've often had the caveat where I'm like, yeah, this seems like a good game, but I don't really get trick-takers. And it's only been recently that I decided I was going to learn like 50 or something like that. And so I started playing tons of them. I played a few classic ones with my wife. Like Joe over at All Play was very kind and sent me a whole bunch of the ones they're doing, and so I've gotten to play Nine Lives and Ghosts of Christmas, which is just so mind-bending, and Sail, which is beautiful, a remake of Hamlin Cove.
Yeah, fantastic game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And just, they are so exciting. A few of the things that had kind of bridged it for me were actually some of these modern hybrid games, like Pierre Sylvester's Brian Boru. Have you played Brian Boru?
I haven't played it yet, but read all about the mechanic, the hybrid with the trick-taking and the crossover. Thought it was very interesting.
I've played that a handful of times, actually, because my parents really enjoy it.
So oh, cool.
I've been able to get it with them, yeah.
Yeah, and it does so many cool things. And of course, Cole Worley sent me a very early production, you know, not a production copy, just a prototype of Arx, which I don't know if you've had the pleasure of trying out Arx now that I think you can play it on
TTS. On Tabletop Simulator, I believe, yeah.
Have you tried it out?
I have not. I've downloaded the mod and looked at it, but have not played it.
Sounds like my life story.
It's a little intimidating. And I love what he's doing there. I had mixed feelings about the game at that time, but that's pretty normal for a Cole Worley game because he breaks the bones of his games over and over during development.
Yeah, they changed so many times.
Yeah.
Good route, right?
Really. If you follow his development process, he is just so willing to throw out ideas and try a new build, and then the next week he's going to try something insane that'll only last for one play. And good job. It seems to work great for him.
Yeah, a lot of good titles out there.
Yeah. But a lot of these hybrid games were what persuaded me, where I was playing enough Brian Boru that I was finally getting it, where I was going like, oh, that's what sluffing is.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe I'm a slow learner in that regard.
No, that's great. I think the idea of trick taking in general, if it's just a trick taking game, I feel like you are in one camp or another. Either you love them or you hate them. I feel like there's very few people that are just like, yeah, I could, you know, if like I'm feeling it that day, you could get me to play one. I feel like online you'll see a lot of people go, oh man, I hate a trick taking game, I don't even want to talk about
just under the trick taker with a twist, right? That's the
So where you get these more modern board games though that are using trick taking as a smaller piece of the main board game, you can sort of sprinkle it in and almost hide it a little bit.
Right.
And that way players are more focused on the main game. So such as Brian Boru, you're worrying about the area control and going up the different tracks, that you're not really focusing on just the trick-taking part. And it can allow you to open yourself up a little bit more.
Yeah, and it's like spinach in a pot pie, you know? It kind of sneaks it in there. And I love the way that it lets you break in without needing to learn all that terminology, without needing to swim with the sharks in the waters they're so such dangerous predators in. Because when I play Brian Boru, I'm more focused on the card play than like a trick, which really lets me escape that danger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the multi-use of the card, usually you're more worried about other things than, like you said, an actual trick. Especially because in Brian Boru, it's may follow. You can play any card you want, except if you're leading, you have to follow the color you choose. But right. It makes it so you're not so worried about exactly the numbers and when you play into the trick, because maybe you just play a lower number because you want the benefits of a track that you're trying to go up versus the trick itself.
Well, and that's one of the points of this Trick Taking Life, this series that I'm writing, is explaining to my past self what trick taking is and why it's interesting and why it has a long history. You know, so I work as a historian, I teach history, and I am just fascinated by games that have a long lineage to them. And trick taking has a very long and storied lineage, but it also has a playfulness. You know, we're not saying that it has a long lineage in the sense that it's dull or staid. It has a long lineage of always morphing and changing and being playful with itself. So this series really is a letter to my past self saying, no, actually this genre shouldn't be dismissed just because, you know, whether because you came from a weird family dynamic or because, you know, your wife is really good at it. Her whole family loves to rumble you when you go over for dinner. This is something worth investigating because, it's a whole world and it's just such an exciting one.
Yeah, 100%. As we're talking, I'm going to sit down to read it properly, and obviously I hope that people at home will as well. But just having a brief skim over the review that you've written, I can see that coming across. You know, you're talking about writing to your past self, and I like the bit where you say, "Is a teaser, every trick taker must contain cute animals. It is lore." You're writing a lot of lores tonight, Dan.
The lawgiver.
There we go.
One, I think it was on the Trumps article, just sprinkling a little more things from your articles without spoiling too much. There was the point where because you were first introduced to how the Trump system worked. And you said something about, like, you played a 10 and then the other lady who was playing with you played a 2 and you were ready to take the trick. But then she playfully slapped your hand and said, no, I played Trump. I win.
Yeah, I was a poor Mormon missionary once, a deeply depressed Mormon missionary. And when you're a Mormon missionary, you are just so desperate for any Mormon of normalcy because you spend 2 years working all day, every day, and immersed in this culture that sometimes is a little difficult. I don't want to get too much into that. But so this family invited us in to play a card game, and I'm going, great. You know, Mormons play card games. Yeah, that's totally normal, right? Like, my family was always playing card games. I'm normal too. And then we play it and she trumps me and it was like the one time I was going to win a trick.
Thought all was good. Do you remember what game it was?
I don't.
Because I don't think the article said the game. I think you were just saying trumps in general.
Yeah. And that's one of the... Growing up, that was one of the weaknesses of trick-taking games, is I would, you know, I had that experience. I think that's the first trick-taker I ever played. And then when my wife's family would introduce me, but sort of parcel with what you were saying about terminology is that oftentimes, because you're always just playing with like a deck of 52, you know, you just have a pack of bicycles, you know, every family has one in a drawer somewhere. And so you open it up and you play a game. But one of the problems that I had was I could never keep it straight because they were always deploying all this specialized terminology and the rules were similar enough, but then with exceptions that I couldn't keep them straight. So I really like the tendency of modern trick takers to dress it up just a little bit so that you can, you know, they have their own deck. like so playing Aurum, for instance, that it comes with the gold cards and it shows you the different base elements on the, those are the suits. You know, you're not just playing with the normal four, you know, face card suits.
Yeah, saying clubs are the gold cards, and you just have to remember the whole time. Yeah. Clubs are gold, and then three tricks in, you're like, wait, spades are gold?
Right.
Yeah, and games like, you know, Euchre, where you have the Bowers, and there's a hilarious Family Guy video. I don't know if you've ever seen it from one of the episodes where Lois tries to explain Euchre. It's pretty funny. I recommend checking it out, and we'll put it. We'll put a link in the show notes for people to listen to it. And,
okay, what a treat!
Or better yet, I can put a sound clip of it for people to hear.
All right, nothing's more fun than a family card game. Now the game is Euchre. Begin by separating the nines, tens, face cards, and aces from the rest of the deck. The goal is to win at least three tricks. Now, if the side that fixed the trump fails to get three tricks, it is said to be euchred. The highest trump is the jack of the trump suit, called the right bower. Partnership-making trump wins three or four tricks and earns 1 point. Lone hand wins three or four tricks, also earns 1 point. However, a lone hand wins five tricks. That's worth 4 points. Many Euchre games are scored by rubber points, as in whist. Oh, the first side to win two games wins the rubber.
But yeah, I get the idea. A lot of traditional games use those same cards over and over again, which is great. A single deck of 52 cards, you can play hundreds of games, but then... Yeah. It's then leaving the players having to remember those special rules depending on the game you're playing. And if you're trying to introduce somebody new, that threshold of getting them on board while everybody else is so far ahead absolutely could push them off, I could see.
You know, and it's kind of an irony, right? That having 100 card games be playable with the same deck means that there's really no gatekeeping. You know, the threshold to entry is as low as the floor. But at the same time, maybe the threshold is so low that it's a step down that you weren't expecting, and I was stumbling over it. Just because I really benefit from seeing like the components that are feeding into or using a setting or a theme or however you want to phrase it, a topic that is helping to glue the rules into your mind. I really appreciate that. Like right here, I have a set of rules because a friend went to Japan, one of their game shows, and actually sent me a copy of a game that I've been really interested in learning because it intersects with my historical education. And that game is, so this is a trick taker, and maybe you've heard of it. It's called Church versus Martin Luther.
Mm-hmm. I have a copy. You probably can see mine right there.
Yeah, a little purple box. Yep. And so I have it. And it arrived just like last week from Japan. This friend was kind enough to send it to me. And I have here the English rules. And I broke it open and I was excited to learn it. And Ryan and Patrick, you're going to be so ashamed of me. I don't actually own a deck of playing cards.
Oh, no bicycles. I thought you were saying there were
no bicycles. And I could go to the grocery store and get one for like $4 or, you know, whatever it costs. But I don't actually own a deck of regular cards. So kind of embarrassing. But I need to get one because this game, it has some special cards that it uses. But it actually requires you to own just a normal deck, which I don't have.
I actually kind of find that surprising because of your wife not potentially having one. Obviously, you play so many games, you should also be having one. So I feel like, yeah, shame on you. Oh. But... I'd have to imagine one of the two of you would just naturally have a deck of cards. That's crazy.
I'm sure we do somewhere, right? They're so ubiquitous.
You almost accidentally just buy those. Like you're at CVS and you buy some candy for the kids and you're just, oh, well, grab a deck of cards while we're at it. Sure.
Right.
But it's funny, isn't it? How much more alluring, though, is the art when you transition that into modern trick takers versus saying, oh, let's get the standard deck of cards out. The feeling's different at the table, isn't it? When you have friends and family over and you say, I've got this game, or you say, well, I've got this deck of cards and here's a game. I know the vibe changes slightly.
Yeah, it feels special. I actually played a trick taker with a friend once, or maybe it wasn't a trick taker, but it was something with a regular deck of cards where he had gone through and with a pen, like crossed out some of the suits and written new information on them, because a deck of cards is so cheap and chintzy, you can do that. But he had basically just made a new game out of it. And I don't remember what that game was, but I do think it was a trick taker.
Was it teach
you? But again, that was in my phase where I was kind of put off by it.
Yeah. Was it potentially teach you?
It may have been.
Okay. So the reason why I'm asking this, because this is a perfect segue into, there was a post probably a month ago. We actually covered it on another episode, so I don't want to spend too much time for Patrick and I. I mainly am trying to get your thoughts on it. There was a poll that was called the Board Game Philosophy Poll, and called What Does It Mean to Play a Game? And the situation was somebody bought a regular deck of cards and Sharpied Dragon, Phoenix, Dog, and Bird on the Jokers. So that way they could have a Teach You deck.
Yeah.
The questions are as follows. There are three questions. Did my friends and I just play Teach You? Would you say yes or no to that?
Yes.
Okay. Second question. Would you recognize that this was a different gaming experience than playing with a published Teach You deck? Yes or no?
Yes.
Okay. And then third question. Is my new creation, the standard deck that I wrote on, a copy of Teach You? Yes or no? And that's where the pause
there
comes.
We go.
This was the most contested question of the whole poll. Most people were in the majority of the way you answered, but this question is what caused like so much chaos on that day on BGG and various servers of people trying to answer this. So what would your, I'll give you a couple more seconds to think, but what would your answer be?
I think it is. And I think that's okay. Not just to say piracy is a moral imperative in an extractive economy, although it is.
It's okay. You're in a safe space here. We have mentioned that many times.
Yeah, Ron's got an editing kit, don't worry.
The quick summary is support the designer, publisher, artist, etc. if you can. But sometimes, especially in the trick-taking world, it's very easy to proxy these games. It's very, very, very hard to get a lot of these games. Sometimes you literally can't buy it. The next best thing you can do is proxy it and still try and support them by showing your love for the game. So with that in mind, you can continue.
Yeah. And, you know, I, as a person who I have created art in the past, and sometimes people have paid me for that art. But at the same time, if somebody couldn't afford it, I would actually, you know, I'm a huge supporter of libraries, right? I want people to be able to experience art and culture and not be priced out of it.
Mm-hmm.
So if somebody is making a knockoff version of Teach You, go for it. Now, at the same time, I hope that those of us who have means are going to support designers and publishers. Like, one of the things that comes to mind with these trick-taking games is how often we're paying for the rules, right? You buy these games, you get a deck of like 30 cards. You could absolutely make that yourself. I was playing Trick Taking in Black and White, which is a game where every card is, it's inverse. There's only two suits. There's a white suit and a black suit. It's a brain-burny little game. You could make that with 3x5 cards in like 2 minutes. Do I think you're losing something in that process? Yeah, sure, a little bit. But if you can't buy this game that's a Japanese import and you want to see what it's about, I actually do think it's morally okay to make the game and play it. And I'm not going to make a prescriptive statement necessarily.
No, yeah, you could stop talking before you dig yourself too far in a hole. Or you can make a law of it. You know, you've already made a couple of laws tonight. Why not make a third?
Yeah, I'm going to declare as law since I'm lawgiver today.
Sounds law.
That it's okay to play games, but that you should be looking out for the people who are creating your games. You should show them some appreciation.
Absolutely. That's very well put. I want to second that law. Can I write my name next to it as well?
Yeah. Now, and that means it's been seconded. So now it is holy law.
Perfect.
I think I'll third it as well. So that was an easy.
Oh, very good.
I've already roped in this far.
So going back to the series itself, you have two written so far. Without giving away too much, can you give us a sneak peek on what the third one might be?
Yeah, so the third one is going to be contract bidding. This is one of those elements that I just did not understand the first few times I played a trick-taking game. Because this is where the, you know, trumps, that was a problem, right? Contract bidding is scary. It's scary, and I know how to play them. So last week, I sat down with both of you and we played 99, which is a pretty loaded game in terms of making a bid. And I loved it, but at the same time, it's very intimidating, especially for someone who's not accustomed to trick-taking games. I remember one of the first times I played a contract bidding game, and they're like, okay, you need to declare how many tricks you're going to win. And I'm going, but you guys keep cheating. Like, it's not just based on how high my cards are. Like, sure, if I have an ace in an ace high game, that you're like, yeah, I can kind of bank on that. Except now I'm introducing trumps, and I'm introducing when you can play offsuit, and you guys are just going to cheat. And it's going to be nonsense. And I'm going to declare like 12 because I don't actually know how to play this game, and then I'm going to win two. And so it's just very intimidating. And so the next entry is going to be about how I got over that terror and learn to love contract bidding. And then I think the series is only going to be four parts. I just want to keep it digestible. But the fourth one is going to be about hybrid games and just where trick taking is taking us, and that it's just super exciting. And we're seeing it all over the place now. And I hope that it reaches a point where, sort of like deck building or tile laying, that it can just be something that appears in a lot of games. And we don't need to be intimidated by it, that it can be a foundation for many experiences.
Yeah, hopefully this push that goes into the trick-taking renaissance will continue to do that, because the comparison to it is the roll and write boom that we had a year and half, 2 years ago. And we're still seeing a lot of roll and writes now. It's not as much as when the boom first started, but they've continued to stay. It wasn't like a 1 year and then they're done and that was it. Now we don't see any more. So I'm hoping trick-taking can hit that point as well, where we start to see it introduced in more games, like you said, with all these hybrid games that we're getting, and then it can get people more comfortable with it and start to introduce it into the more mainstreaming gaming, and it stops becoming a filler-only game and can actually be a game night game.
Yeah. And, you know, and games like Brian Boru and Arx, I think, are just perfect at that. Because they use trick-taking as a shorthand for, you know, interfactional politics or the limitations of a political maneuver. And in a way that I think we all understand, right? Like, so years ago, there was a deck-building boom. And deck-building is very versatile, and it lets us portray randomness in a very interesting way. That, you know, you insert all of these things into a system and they will all occur, but in what order, and is it going to be opportune or inopportune? And now you can find deck building as a subsystem in so many board games and card games that you really don't need to explain it. Like when Dominion first came out, like it had to explain to you how deck building worked and really belabor it in the rule book. And now games are just kind of like, yeah, and when your draw pile is empty, you shuffle your discard, and that's your new draw pile. And it just shorthands it. We've all learned the system, and now it can just effortlessly slide into new things. And I really hope trick-taking gets there, because I think it's exciting. And I think it lends a lot of, you know, that slight skill card play to games that would really benefit from it.
And so in terms of your trick-taking collection now, Dan, obviously you're not going to be limiting yourself to 11, 12 games plus a few John Perry games. How big is your current trick-taking collection?
I bet it is tiny compared to both of yours, but I just look around the house and it's everywhere right now. So, I mean, I look... Oh, look, here's February and Jiraku and one of my favorites, Cat in the Box. And oh my goodness, right here I have Tall Tales.
These little boxes can hide everywhere.
All over the place. The conveyor belt keeps coming.
Yeah, they're just stacked. Now, I did, in trying to hit my goal of playing like 50 trick takers, I was very fortunate to have some friends from online forums, from Discords, from Slacks, and some readers even, who were very kind and sent me some of their more rare trick takers to borrow. Right. And they're tiny, which makes that kind of offsets the board game shipping crisis a little bit, doesn't it?
That always helps.
So they were kind enough to send me some trick taking games that I, especially imports, that I couldn't have gotten otherwise. And some of those I've returned and some I haven't, but I'm a huge thank you to some of my friends and forum mates and readers who sent me those trick takers so I could play games I otherwise would not have had the opportunity to.
Yeah. So what I wanted to ask then, of those games that you've now acquired or borrowed, which one's your favorite? Have you got a favorite?
Oh,
always a tough question.
It is.
It is hard. I think the one that I reflexively reach toward is Shamans. I adore Shamans. And to me, Shamans, have you played Shamans?
I have.
Guilty confession. I moved it on without having played it because I acquired Inside Job. And I thought, oh, well, it does a similar thing. But okay. I probably should have played Shamans before I moved it on because it went to a bring and buy. Somebody else grabbed hold of it. The money went to charity. I feel good about it. But that's not the point. I really should have played it. And now you're going to tell me how great it is, Dan. I'm going to have to go back and get it.
Oh, it's garbage.
Right.
You can
stay clear.
Terrible.
I still feel good about telling you to keep Inside Job and get rid of Shamans.
Oh, interesting. So I haven't played Inside Job. And maybe I should. To me, Shamans is an exemplar of what we're seeing from hybrid design. Because it's hidden roles, but it even does some clever stuff with its hidden roles that I wish other hidden role games would do. It just does so many things well. And I can play it with people who aren't into trick taking, and they will be invested enough in the hidden roles to sort of forgive the trick taking. Not that trick taking needs forgiveness, but, you know, we're talking about people who are board game bigots. And I love it for that. That's the one I instinctively reach for.
Interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I still think it's a great choice for it. Even though I personally prefer Inside Job, Shamans is still a very good social deduction trick-taking game that, again, leans more towards allowing the social deduction to shine through so that you can sort of hide the trick-taking element in there. Shamans is a may follow the whole time. You can always play whatever card you want. There becomes that loose definition that a lot of people think, well, is it really a trick taker? You're just playing a card. There's no like strict trick taking rules that normally apply in a may follow. I'm not going to try and go down that rabbit hole right now. But with Inside Job, it's a must follow trick taker, but the bad guy is allowed to may follow. So there's only one player that can. So the normal trick taking flow applies a little bit more in that one.
Well, here, let me offer a runner-up.
Okay.
Because this might be surprising, because I've only played it once. And I actually, the only time I've played it has been with you two.
Oh, I'm so excited. Okay, there so actually, go. I want to save it for a second, because we were going to try and get all your thoughts on that game.
Okay.
Because I'm so glad that this is going to be the runner-up. And I hope soon it will be the first answer that you always give. But before we get into that, I just want to go back to 99 real quick, because that was the other game we played with each other. And going into the contract bidding and just bidding in general and trick-taking games. And how that's such a difficult barrier for a lot of players. And that as soon as you add bidding into a trick-taking game, it like increases the level of difficulty because you're asking players to analyze and without knowing the flow of a trick-taking game or even between one to another. If you're playing Spades versus Skull King, how tricks resolve in those games are completely different. And unless you've played it before, you're not going to know right away. So I want to hear from you how you felt about 99's bidding system.
You know what I really liked about it was that it forced you to screw up your hand. what I like about it is, you know, a lot of the times in bidding, it'll ask you to declare your number, right? Or whatever. I like that this asks you to declare your number with the cards, with the suits that you're playing, because that added a really fascinating element to me. Because I was sitting there thinking, well, don't I need this card in order to win this number of tricks? So I really dug it. And I've played other games where you make your bid, but it's the number on the card that you play, which isn't that something you do in Arum? Is you actually declare your bid with the card you play. And so a little bit similar. And I like that. To be forced to use your hand sort of for that extra layer.
Mm-hmm. And Nokus Dice does something similar as well with the leftover die that you have. That number on the value of the die becomes the number of tricks you need.
Raiders as well.
Yep. And 7-segment tricks, the number of pieces that you have left over ends up becoming your bid. So yeah, I personally like those styles where it's a moving bid.
Dynamic.
Yeah, and I've played a few games where it allows you some flex. You gave an example there. I'm also thinking of, what's it called? Anansi, where you're sort of making your bid as you play, which I really like. Arum does that where you can swap out your bid mid trick, which I do like. And I am planning in my piece on contract bidding to highlight those, that it allows you to offset some of that early pressure where, yeah, you're making a bid and that's tense and that's exciting, right? The tension is exciting, especially once you get over the terror of a new player having to analyze their whole hand, but giving someone just that little bit of an out, but usually an out that's a sacrifice. Like, because in Arum, for instance, you're sacrificing a gold card and those are also your trumps and also worth points. And so changing your bid is kind of a sacrifice.
Right, it's an interesting juxtaposition. It could be your downfall, but it's also sometimes you need to do these things in order to have some flexibility in your hand or to improve your position at the same time. So it's a bit of a brain scratcher, and some people love that way of thinking and others not so much.
Yeah.
All right, so getting back to, I'm sure the suspense is there. What is that second game that you are going to say?
So we played this last week and I was just utterly charmed by it because in a way it leans into, pardon my French, but the bull crap that so often comes up in trick taking games where, you know, I'm shooting for a certain number of bids or I'm sure that I'm going to win this trick and then somebody trumps me or everyone works together to block my bid. This is a game that just puts that front and center in such an unrelenting way that it kind of circles around and makes it more approachable again, because I'm expecting that I'm going to be having that, oh, that was ridiculous moment, 5 or 6 times per minute almost. The game is Schadenfreude, which I loved. Absolutely smitten with it when I played it with you two. I think I didn't win.
It doesn't matter.
I don't even remember who won, which is a sign that I really had a great time.
We were actually close to all of us losing, which is another part of this game that's just hilarious and is so fun.
Yeah.
Because you, I think, got Patrick to exactly 40 points. You thought he was going to go over, and then it would have put you in second place and you would have won. But on the last trick, he was able to cancel a card, which got him to exactly 40 points. And then it pushed you and me up to, I think, like 34 and 36, respectively.
Yeah.
And so we were going to that last round with all of us like a single card away from busting. And it's so funny when you get into those moments of that game.
I think we all bust in the end, didn't we? That's the thing. You can all bust and nobody can win, right? It's hilarious.
Yeah, I think that's what happened, actually, thinking back.
Yes, actually, I'm looking at it now. Dan had 44, Patrick, you had 45, and I had 47. So we did all lose.
All losers together, so right? There's no real bad facts of that.
Oh, man. Such a good time. So yeah, so what beyond that, I guess, made it stick out for you? Because I don't think we really explained the big hook of it, of where like the second card played wins, which is a huge difference for normal trick taking.
Yeah.
So I think when I was explaining the rules too, you kind of went like, oh, like that hadn't shown up for you before. Different. So was that the first time you'd ever seen one do that?
It is. Yeah, that's the first time I've seen that. And you know what I loved about it is I do think that one of the inherent weaknesses of trick taking, and this is something that trick take, you know, and this is not a bad thing. I think every mechanism has its potential downfalls. It has its hiccups that its designers need to look out for. And one of the ones with trick taking is if you get a card, if you get a hand with a bunch of high cards, you can depend on that. You know that you're going to win certain tricks or be very likely to. That can inform a lot of your bid. So if, for instance, if we play a contract bidding game and I get all four aces or all four high cards, even if there's trump, I'm going to have an easier time making my bid than you might if you've got a handful of six, sevens, eights, right? Now, I don't think that that is bad. But I think that it creates an inherent limitation where we're working with an asymmetrical decision space where my decision might be easier to make than yours. And what I loved, absolutely loved about Schadenfreude is that you kind of love those hands. You love the high hands because you can use them to force someone to win a second hand. And you love the mid cards because those are things you can maybe win. And you love the low cards because you can kind of use them to needle at people. And I think it adds a lot of texture all throughout the deck, no matter what the numbers are in your hand. And it makes it feel very strategic in a way I haven't encountered elsewhere. I found it was very exciting.
Yeah, the option of playing certain cards, knowing if you have multiples of those in your hand, can sometimes make it a little easier because eventually, like when you get later in the hand, there's a better chance of short suiting happening. So if you play, let's say you lead with a five, you always win the card you play if it's the second highest. If you have a five in your score pile, they're going to cancel each other out. So sometimes when you lead that, the other players know, oh, well, if they're going to win it, they're going to cancel it. Let's make sure we give them another higher point card, or I'll just take it instead because I need points. And the game revolves around different game states. Depending on where you are at that 40-point threshold will determine what you're trying to do. And that's what I really love about the game, is one player can be playing a trick-taking game while another player is playing a trick avoidance game.
Yeah.
I just think it's a really neat dynamic that within a single hand, players can be playing a slightly different game.
You know, and I love that blackjack element to it, where you're trying to bust some people over a certain number. I played another game by Taiki Shinzawa, American Bookshop. Have you played that one?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Where that one is really directly tinkering with that kind of blackjack space, right? Where right when you hit a number, the trick is over. And so everyone is summing their cards when you play it, and you're trying to time out. Do you want all the cards to go in, or do you want this particular trick to bust? And but I think I actually prefer what this one is doing with the trick taking, kind of with that long, that blackjack mechanism with that long score that you're trying to bust some people over, because it really gives you some offensive options. Both offensive in the sense that they're aggressive and offensive in the sense that they're insulting, because it's so mean.
Speaks true to the name.
You can very directly target people.
Yeah, and I thought Sticker was mean, and then I played, wait for it, I always butcher the name. I used to call it Schadenfreude, but it was Schadenfreude, and you did a great job, Dan. I wasn't sure you were going to hit the name the first time, but you remembered that from last time, so that's
Patrick
great.
Is well known for mispronouncing names of games. It's hilarious.
I'll have to lean into it now, otherwise it's gonna people will be offended.
Yeah, I love Scoot and Fruity.
Scoot and Fruity, yeah. Scoot and Fruity is a great game. It's the only game that I've bought a corner rounder for. Of course, Schadenfreude, Schadenfreude, whatever we want to call it, because the cards were in the first edition and were all pointed. And literally you felt pain when you held them in your hands. It's that thematic. Fortunately, they've invested in rounding the corners in the newer editions, but just a nice little touch when you touch the cards.
Yeah, I own the second and third edition currently, but after we played the game, Dan loved it so much that he was like, I need to buy a copy. I was like, well, I've got you covered. I have the third edition. It's an extra copy for this exact reason. I was almost ready for it. I was like, I hope he loves it. And the fact that you immediately wanted it, I'm like, this is perfect.
I am so grateful that you have a copy for me, because I am in love. I can't wait to play that in person.
I should really play it more, actually. It reinvigorated my love for it, too, when we played it together the other day. It's a casualty of having too many trick takers and then realizing there's some trick takers that really rise to the top. And this game is one of those games. If you like the blackjack feel at the end, then I'd also suggest, Dan, trying Cauldron 15. I'm not sure if you've tried that, but...
Okay, let me write that down.
Everybody has a number 15. You're trying to get as close as you can to 15 at the end of three rounds, and people can bust over it as well. It does feel less mean than this game. I keep saying this. Notice I'm saying this game now to avoid saying the name of the game again, because... But I know Ryan loves Cauldron 15 as well. So that's a similar mechanic.
Okay.
That ties with this game quite nicely.
Yeah, and it is one you'd have to import, but thankfully there's been a newer reprint of the game, so it's significantly easier to get a hold of. It is, it's a good one. I like Cauldron 15 more than American Bookshop, and those are similar. And like Patrick said, with a little bit of the Schadenfreude, blackjacky feeling that you get. Yeah. And if you really want to go full blackjack, I don't know if you've heard of roulette taking.
I don't think so.
That's a good one too. You're literally playing roulette with trick taking, and it's quite fun.
Cool.
Yeah.
Cool.
Well, besides, I mean, we could go down to lots of different games, so I want to avoid just continue the rabbit hole here. staying a little on topic. I actually was curious, because we've been talking like pretty much strictly trick-taking only, which we do a lot on the show. Patrick and I are very well known to like trick-taking more than climbing shedding games. Hmm. And my question for you, is that the same? Do you like trick-taking more? Have you not really experienced a lot of climbing shedding games to have an answer? Or which one do you think you do prefer?
At this point, trick-taking is just taking off so much. So I've played Scout, and I like Scout a lot. That's one of those games that I will take to a family gathering, just because anyone can pick it up really quickly. I think Scout is quite charming, but I think actually that might be the only ladder climbing game I've played. Is that a ladder climbing game? I'm even fuzzy on the terminology.
Yeah. I mean, it would be. It's one of those things where, you know, people say, oh, trick taking, shedding, climbing, they're all the same. And then people will scoff at you when you say that. So you got to be careful sometimes when you do it.
Yeah.
But yes, the idea of, you know, climbing games is you're always trying to play cards that are higher than what's currently in play.
Oh, I actually did play another one that someone said was like the Scout Killer. It was like a train one.
The Hachi Train?
Yeah, I've played that one.
Yeah, there's the common Hachi Train, Delt, also known as Crass Kyriert, and Scout that all get compared to each other.
Okay.
Did you enjoy it, Hachi Train?
Yeah, I like Scout better.
Okay.
But when we played it, somebody mentioned, like, oh, this is the game that a bunch of people say is better than Scout, which maybe set me up to be defensive.
Okay.
No, that's fair. That's one of those things, too. Like, if you toss that question out there, you're going to get like 30 replies immediately of, oh, this game, I will die on this hill. This is the better game.
And like, right. They're all different.
Because they're very similar to each other, but they all have, like most of these games, that one little twist that makes it different.
Yeah.
And it's a big enough difference that there is a true feeling on how they play. For me, my favorite between all of them is Delt. I like Delt the most.
Okay.
And that one's more of a trick-taking, climbing, shedding all in one, because instead of continuously going around the table, you have one opportunity to play a trick. It resolves. Whoever played the highest combination leads the next one, and then they'll go once around. And the idea is you're still trying to shed all of your cards, but in true German fashion, it's one of those where there's only one loser and everyone else wins. And that's the one reason why a lot of people don't like that one, is people need a clear winner.
Sure.
What can happen with Hachi Train? I mean, I'm team Hachi Train, if I had to say, of those games. I haven't played Doubt, I will caveat that. But you can see straight away, Dan, how mixed it is in terms of...
All three of us have a different answer to it. It's great.
Yeah.
There we go.
And 6 months ago, I would not have delineated between a trick taker and a ladder climber. right? Like, I was playing Scout, and I was like, oh, this is just a trick taker with different, you know.
Blaspheme! Don't say that!
And now I'm going, I'm not going to put Scout in my series on trick taking. It is a different genre, but I get why they're lumped together.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I'm not one for crazy terminology like that, because that sort of, this is a bit of aggressive, but it sort of becomes the gatekeepery part of it. If somebody is exactly. new to, yeah, they're saying like, oh, this is a trick taking game. And you're like, no, it's not. It's only a climbing game. Like, they're going to feel bad. And they're like, okay, well then I'm not going to play this with you anymore.
Yeah.
So like, it's fine. Yeah, sure. It's a trick taking game. And then once they start to play a few more, they on their own can now figure out the true difference between them.
Yeah.
Right. We're trick talkers. The irony, of course, we're not climber talkers, but yet we talk about all of these games. So it's an interesting soup.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Dan, I know we don't want to keep you too long. I'm sure you have other things that you need to get to. So unless Patrick has any other questions, I did have one final one, but I'll see if Patrick has anything first.
So no further questions from me, Dan, but keep doing what you're doing. I'm really looking forward to, and I know Ryan is, I'm sure, as well, and a lot of people are listening to, seeing how this the articles develop and seeing what you discover, and we'd love to have you on the show again.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I'm absolutely excited about just how much this genre is taking off. And I appreciate, especially, I love what you are doing with this podcast, because I love the idea of people who are just digging in instead of just, oh, you know, what's the new thing, but really digging into a genre and focusing on it. I love that we have people doing that. So keep on keeping on.
Yeah, we appreciate that. We love doing it. We're coming up on almost a year, which is crazy to me.
That's scary. I'll probably go out of bed in that time.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, so my question I have for you actually comes from my wife. She was like, whenever you have a guest on, you need to ask this question now. So I am making sure that I do this. So the question is, if you were to jump into any board game world, what would it be? And just to further clarify for you and the listeners, this is like Jumanji style. If you opened up a board game box and it Ooh. Came to life, and like you were able to dive into the world and be a part of it, what, and this can be a board game, trick-taking game, whatever, what game would it be?
Santa Monica.
Okay.
Have you heard of Santa Monica?
Yeah, on the beach, you play the cards out, the little sand dollars and stuff.
Yeah, it's Santa Monica is not a groundbreaking game, but it uses negative space in a fascinating way, where you can put out a card. It's a little tableau builder where you're creating a stretch of the Santa Monica beach. And what's so fascinating about it is just that it leans into this idea that when you have one of these destination making tableau builders, that not only should it be fun in the sense that you're creating combos and scoring and putting out little points that build up and play off of each other, but you should also be able to explore it. Because in that game, you also put down like little tourists and little townies, and they can move around, and you're trying to move them to specific destinations on the beach to play volleyball or to see some sort of tourist destination. And it's just such a pleasant game that does bring back memories of times that I went to Santa Monica and was on the beach and got to kind of walk around and explore. It's just so effortlessly pleasant. And I wish more designers of tableau builders would recognize that, you know, it's not enough all the time to create these games where you're making a beautiful place. I also want to go into those places. And Santa Monica does that in a way that I think is lovely.
That's a great answer, because it's a good answer for the question, and you've actually done it, which is cool.
That is a very unique question, and a lot of people would immediately be like, oh, Candyland or something, but that was, you know, well thought out there, Dan, which kind of gives me one more question, and it might be the same answer. What's your desert island game? So you've got Santa Monica as the jump into universe, but if you had to take one game with you to play forever or till you were rescued, which game would you take?
Ooh, I don't think I have an answer for that one, just because I'm one of those people, I love bouncing between games, but I think right now maybe because I'm playing a play-by-email version of this game over on Yukata, but I would probably pick Pax Perfiriana.
Interesting.
That's the first PAX game. It's also kind of the last PAX game in the sense that you kind of come full circle and it's the best one all over again. I don't know if you've played any of the PAX games or PAX Perfiriana.
Yeah, a couple. Not PAX Perfiriana, though. I've not played that one.
Yeah, more people are getting into that world largely through Cole Worley's PAX Pamir.
Yep.
Which I do think is an excellent game. It's one of my favorite games ever designed, but I think PAX Perfiriana is what I would take to the island.
So you could almost buy a 52 deck of cards and then Sharpie all of the PAX information on them, right, though? And then you still have a deck of cards and then you can play other games as well.
Everybody wants to play.
The irony is that if I were to make my own, you know, if I went out and bought five packs of bicycles and made my own PAX Perfiriana deck with a Sharpie, it would look about as coherent as Phil Eklund's cards do.
I mean, it's funny because it's true.
That game's graphic design is just wild.
Yeah. It's something, that's just for sure. Sorry, Patrick, you're going to say
something? No. We've gone to a desert. We've taken him to a desert island and we've pushed him to the universe with Santa Monica. And very well answered. And I will have to try PAX Port. Again, I'm doing the pronunciation thing. Just give it me again.
I love that you picked this game because it's a hard one to pronounce. So
that's why you chose it, right? That's the whole reason.
So it's PAX Scudenfruity.
There you go.
Scudenfruity. It's in there somewhere. I'll try to remember it.
Perfect. Awesome. Well, thank you again, Dan, for taking the time out to come on the show with us. And like we said, we had a lovely time. Hope you did as well. Yeah, this was great.
I did. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm sure even if you're not on another episode in the near future, definitely let's play some more games.
Get you something to write about.
Let's do it.
Yeah, get some more Scudenfruity played and maybe get you some more 99 action to have some redemption. Yeah. And actually, real quick, Dan, is there any other things you wanted to plug for yourself besides the Space Biff website?
No, that's fine. Come read Space Biff. Don't read Space Biff. Don't let me tell you how to live your life, you know?
Perfect. Yeah, I do thoroughly enjoy your rules on your website of like why you do and don't review things. So definitely when you go to the website, check that out. It's a good read before you actually read any of the articles.
Well, thank you.
Thanks for listening. And hopefully you'll remember that Dan has also set three laws on this episode that will continue after the episode for the indefinite future.
Absolutely. All right. Thanks again.
See you around.